The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum of Accelerated Government Strategies, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum from Accelerated Government Strategies, providing advisory consulting for innovative startups to help grow government revenue. Every week, Aileen and Gigi welcome Washington, D.C.'s most ambitious and influential female executives who are taking risks to engineer success and shape the future. Women of Washington on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now your hosts, Aileen Black and Gigi Shum.
I'm Aileen Black.
And I'm Gigi Shum.
Today, our guest is Admiral Michelle Howard. Admiral Howard is a United States Navy admiral who currently serves as the 38th Vice Chief of Naval Operations. Prior to that, she served as the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Operations Plans and Strategy. Admiral Howard has achieved many historical firsts throughout her naval career. She was the first African-American woman to command a U.S. Navy ship and the first to achieve the three-star rank. In 2006, she was selected for rank of Rear Admiral, making her the first admiral selected from the U.S. Naval Academy class of 1982 and the first female graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy selected for flag rank. On July 1, 2014, Admiral Howard became the first woman to become a four-star admiral. As Vice Chief of Naval Operations, which she began that same day, she is the first African-American and the first woman to hold that post.
Admiral Howard, many of our guests are inspired by people that influence them or events that influence them early in their life. I've heard you speak about your family. So tell us a little bit about that. Where are you from? And tell us about your family growing up.
So my father was an Air Force Master Sergeant. He met my mother when he was stationed in Mendenhall, England. She was in a nursing program at the time. And then it was during that period that they married. I had my older brother in England, and then they came back to the United States. So this was in the 50s. And then by the time they were done, there were four of us. My older brother, I'm number two, my younger brother and my sister. And so we moved a lot because he was stayed in the Air Force up until I was 12 when he retired to Colorado. And then so we lived in Colorado three times, and then I went to high school there after he retired.
Did you ever live overseas while you were growing up, or was he mainly stationed over here after you were born?
We lived in Guam, and that's where my younger brother was born. So my older brother was born in England. I was born in California. My younger brother was born in Guam, and my sister was born in Colorado.
Was there a particular person or events in your life that you look back and you see them as a turning point or just maybe inspirational?
So one of the things I've thought about over the years is how encouraging my parents were. And at the time we were growing up, my mother had a high school, basically the equivalent of a high school education. And my father had gotten his GED when he went into the Air Force. He had quit school to help go raise the rest of the family. He had to go earn a living and contribute to the family income so that they could eat. And so they were really big on us reading, and they would give us books. And I think about it. They had us all reading by the time we were five. And my mother was pushing me college-level books when I was around 10, 11, and 12. And so the Buffalo Soldiers, books on leaders, and we would have weekly trips to the library. And those people and those books were wonderful leaders and gave us the notion of this promise of opportunity in this country. And I really appreciate my parents doing that.
It sounds like that she not only was choosing college-level books to grow your skill level, but that she was also picking particular stories that she felt would give you maybe a vision or path as to what your future could be.
So And in fairness, I think she took each of us as being different human beings. I remember my younger brother getting Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee when he was starting the fourth grade. The one thing she had all of us read was the Lewis and Clark journals, the original journals. She said, if you're American, you should appreciate what it took for this country to be made. So I think my favorite book she gave me, though, was she gave me The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings when I was about 11. That was really fun reading.
I read those books too. It was fascinating. It was really the first time that I can remember reading a book that presented a whole different world that by the time you got through the series, you were just completely invested in. And of course, way before the movies were made or anything.
So. Yes, yes. And the importance of purpose in life. Yes.
I read something else your mom did, the One Match Challenge.
Yes.
So can you tell us about that?
Yes, my mother grew up in World War II in England, and so everybody was basically girl guides or boy guides, and they were actually taught some fundamental skills in case the Germans invaded, you know, how to smuggle messages in their loafers and how to survive in the woods in case they had to evacuate the towns. So outdoor life for her always had this sort of underlay meaning of true survival. And she was a Girl Scout leader most of my life, even most of my adult life in this country. And then she just sort of had this really intense perspective of a personal challenge. And her rule was, at some point, you had to demonstrate to her that you could start a campfire with a single match. And there was she used to say, then there's no cheating, there's no paper. You're going to get tinder from underneath pine trees, your kindling, your logs, you're going to set your fire, and then you're going to use one match to light it off. And for her, I think growing up in World War II, matches were really still precious, and they were concerned that if they would have to evacuate, every match was going to matter. They weren't going to be able to get more. And so the other part to this challenge would be that she would just sort of, we camped several times a year. She would just sort of randomly pick a day and say, today's the day, one match fire. And, you know, there'd be this intense pressure. Well, the other thing is she told us that if our fire failed to start, that was it. We weren't going to get any heated meals that night. We weren't, there's going to be no singing around, you know, no fire, none of that. And she would remind us, and that means there's no s'mores. And
wow.
So this pressure. And so we were camping. So we were stationed in Alaska for 3.5 years. And we are out at Mount McKinley National Forest. And it's pouring with rain. And my sister is 7 years old. And all of a sudden, my mother that night, we're getting back. We are so looking forward to a hot meal. We've been hiking. And she's like, Lisa, today's the day. One match fire. And it was so outrageous. My older brother, younger brother, and I were like, no, this can't, you know, mom, this is insane. And, you know, being a mom, she just looked at us. We were done. And so then we figured out if my sister was going to do it, we were going to have to work as a team. So my older brother gave up his poncho. My younger brother and I, Roger, we helped her get her stuff together, but she had to build it underneath the poncho. And my younger brother and I and older brother are holding this poncho barely above the ground. And she just does this whole like sports twisting body thing to get underneath it. And then, you know, she lit her match and the fire started and we were just ecstatic. And we were running around like we'd made a touchdown in a football game and pounding her on the back. And, you know, it was fantastic. And one of the things over time I realized is my mother was teaching us team building skills. You know, when you work together, you're successful. And she was also giving us some very simple leadership lessons. There's standards in life. You got to meet them. And if you don't meet them, you suffer consequences. Now, interestingly enough, when I think back, there was whatever day she picked, we all lit the match. It was every day that she picked for the four of us, we were all successful. And so years later, when I finally thought about it and I wrote it up as a speech for a leadership conference, I had her read the speech and she was laughing. She goes, well, first of all, Michael tells the story much better than you do. She goes, but second of all, you missed one of the biggest leadership points. And I go, what's that, Mom? And she said, look, a leader knows when to challenge their people. I never picked a day when you guys weren't ready for the challenge.
What amazing story.
It is, and it's true. So it's it's even better.
Today, our guest is Admiral Michelle Howard, Vice Chief of Naval Operations. Coming up, we'll ask about women in leadership positions in the Navy. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on frontalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, our guest is Admiral Michelle Howard, Vice Chief of Naval Operations. Now, Admiral, you and I are about the same age, and I was also a military dependent and moved around while I was growing up. Some of the places we moved proved to present bigger cultural barriers for myself and my peers, especially with diverse backgrounds. What was your experience moving around across the country, you know, with some very different locations?
So because my mother came from another country, my parents would really work to make sure, even if my dad got orders, we would try and move over the summer. And so there were times it was just her and the four of us. He's already moved ahead. And then sometimes it was all six of us packed in a car. I remember her really going out of her way we would stop every major city, every museum. And so we got this great, my sister refers to it as enforced cultural learning. Just understanding America and all the different aspects of it, everything, you know, whether it's the biggest ball of twine in the middle of country or it's a Native American museum in Cody. It was just some really great memories and education traveling around. It wasn't always, so this was the 60s and 70s. And there were some very negative experiences in those days. I think we're in Utah and we were on our way to Alaska from Massachusetts and we stopped for a meal and could not get service. So my dad had us do our own little mini sit-in right there, and then we just waited for a couple hours, and then it was clear we weren't going to get service, so we moved on. There were times we couldn't get hotel rooms, and so we slept in the back of the car. Remember that as a kid? And you just really don't understand that, what's going on. When we lived in Massachusetts, busing was just starting to come. That was 67, 68. That was when Martin Luther King was assassinated. I remember the school taking a minute of silence, the principal coming over the 1MC. That was a tough year for me. I got beat up a lot. I used to have to run home trying to outchase kids who just, they didn't know me. They just knew they didn't like the color of my skin. And that was the year my father taught me to box. And thinking back, you know, at the time as a little girl, I understood what my father was teaching me, how to box with my brothers. He wanted me to be able to defend myself. You know, but at this point in my life, I think back and I realized how hard that must have been for him, that as a dad, he could not protect his daughter at school. And there would be nothing he could say or do that would change the way the kids were behaving, that sort of a de facto, well, this is just the way it is. You people don't necessarily belong here.
You joined the military and started your career over 30 years ago. And you made the decision to opt into a field that you must have known was going to be a very male-dominated field, certainly when you began it by going
all
to the...
All fields were male-dominated.
Fields were male-dominated, but some more than others. Some more than others, right? And certainly starting...
So let's see. We're talking the 70s. The two that weren't were probably nursing and teaching.
Exactly.
Okay, so it didn't matter what you were going to do.
No, and I'll share with you, my mom was a teacher, and she said she was a teacher because at the time there were two options, and her dad said, don't be a nurse, go be a teacher. And so although my mom loved teaching more than anything, she said to me, don't be a teacher, go do something else.
So when I was in third grade, one of the things they had us do was the teacher had us write, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? And it was just a one-page essay. And I You know, and in those days, you're just going to the library and looking at different things. But I was pretty curious. And I had decided I was going to be a zoologist. And I wrote that up in my paper. And now I think she was a great teacher. She sat down at one point throughout the next week and talked to each of us about 10 minutes about our decisions. And I'll never forget, because she was like, well, you know, Michelle, women are, you're probably going to be a nurse or, you know, a teacher, you know. And I said, but no, Madame Curry was a woman. I don't get why I can't be a zoologist. She just looked at me like, ah, okay, we're done here.
Like, what am I going to do with this one, right?
Yeah.
So what was it like back in the day? You went to the Naval Academy and you were in one of the very first classes.
I was in the third year group, yeah.
That admitted women. And then, you know, graduated and started your Navy career. And it was, you know, you were surrounded by men. You know, how was that back in those days? How was it being just one of the very, very few?
So the 70s, lots of challenges. And, you know, and that happens when you engender change in a society. And I remind people, you know, that was that, you know, about the time I'm applying, that's when Sandra Day O'Connor's being nominated for the Supreme Court. And I don't know if people remember the national headlines just over her being nominated, you know. And then Sally Ride hadn't yet gone up in space. And there was a series of articles during that time frame over the early women police officers and firefighters. And I'll never forget all the conversation over whether or not women firefighters could, you know, do the job. So those prevailing attitudes by the dominant group were definitely still in the service. And so there were folks, men who, you know, were working to get us to leave the service. And I suspect that was going on across all different occupations. That's just sort of where society was. I think our image of women was not Sandra Day O'Connor. It was Charlie's Angels. And we just had to work our way through all of that.
Did you develop any techniques early on? Some people use humor, some pick fights, some are the smartest person in the room. Some people build bridges and are very sociable people. What worked for you?
So starting off at Annapolis, what worked for me was my roommates. There were four of us. And we had actually started with five of us. And our first roommate quit that summer. And after that, we got together and talked. And we made a pact with each other that we would not quit immediately. That if any of us got to the point where we were going to quit, we had to have a conversation with the other three roommates and convince them that we were quitting for our own reasons and not because we were being pressured out. And that worked. And all four of us graduated.
Your career in the Navy and the rise through the ranks have been historic. You were the first one in the Naval Academy classes to admit men. You were the first one in your class to be an admiral, right?
Yes.
You were the first African-American woman to command a ship. You were the first three-star, first four-star. I mean, I could go on and on. But the one thing I found in all the research I did in the interviews was everybody wanted to talk to you about what was like being the first. And what I kept on looking at was your accomplishments. You have an enormous amount of awards and medals. And my father is a retired officer and has a lot, but you have a ton. Do you ever find it frustrating that people don't want to just talk to you about your experience? I mean, you beat all odds, men or women.
So, no, I mean, it's just what captures the public's imagination. And, you know, I stayed operational and I deliberately went to sea and tried to stay at sea. And so that's where the opportunities to have these miraculous missions come your way. If you're not at sea, in the case of the Navy, then you should be desiring to go to sea. That's where we do our primary mission of protecting national security interest and protecting individuals, protecting Americans. That's what we're supposed to do at sea, as well as further the ideals of the Constitution.
You are highly decorated. You have a chest full of medals there. What one do you feel most proud to be wearing?
Ooh. So one of them is a humanitarian assistance medal ribbon that we received for the work we did off the tsunami work off of Indonesia. And I'll never forget when we finally got ashore and could work with the Indonesians, how important that was to the people. They didn't have anything at that point, but the survivors were coming out and treating us literally like rock stars. They were mobbing us as we were walking around. And very few English speakers in the part of Jakarta that we were in, but they were shaking our hands and grabbing us and hugging us as we delivered food and water. It's, when people are in need and you can help them, you literally... the other thing I remember about that mission was the simplicity of the guidance we got. And it just said, make best speed for Indonesia. Prevent suffering, prevent further suffering, and save lives. That's what we were told to do. And that's a fabulous way to give guidance. Direct, simple, concise. And then let the team figure out how to do those things.
Today our guest is Admiral Michelle Howard, Vice Chief of Naval Operations. Coming up, we'll ask Admiral Howard about STEM and how to fill the STEM pipeline. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, our guest is Admiral Michelle Howard, Vice Chief of Naval Operations.
Admiral Howard, we've had many female guests who are flag officers on here. And when we ask them, they often do credit the military and its system of how you have a well-defined role. And if you do it well, then you have certain opportunities. And that career ladder is laid out in a way that's a lot clearer sometimes than in private industry.
So I agree. I think I read a report by McKinsey where they had done a study, and one of the biggest threads they found from women across all the services is they talked about the meritocracy of the military. But it's actually in the Navy even more self-reinforcing than that. When I've talked to civilian women and they talk about the dynamics of meetings and then being heard and things like that, I'm thinking, I've never had that experience. And then I realized when you're on a ship, you are trained for a specific job on that ship. You are the chief engineer. You are the operational officer. You are the weapons officer, whatever your job is. And some of the pipelines to get to those jobs is pretty lengthy. Well, when there's no spares on a ship. And you're it. When I was chief engineer, and I was going up and talking to the captain about issues with the plant, there's no turning to some guy and going, well, is what Michelle's saying? What do you, no, you're it. And so in the dynamics, when we would get together as a team, you're the expert in your area, and they're really, other people may have thoughts, but they're reinforcing normally, but they're you own it, and there's not somebody behind you that, your boss is going to look over your shoulder and try and get another opinion. You own it. And so the dynamics of how that plays out, I think, is very different in the military than in another environment where you could bring in a larger team and you might more easily be able to ignore the voice of the person who's, they're in the seat, but you're not comfortable having them in the seat. They don't have their trust. And I think the dynamics for women is we still are in a place, particularly in non-traditional roles, where we have to earn that trust. And I refer to it as the luxury of being average. In the environment, men have the luxury of being average. When they walk on board a ship, people go, oh, okay, he's so-and-so. And the trust is there because they're part of the dominant group. Whereas if you don't look like the dominant group, you are forced to earn that trust up front, no matter what rank you are. And so eventually, as we become a greater percentage of women and start looking like the demographics of America, and the other thing that's happening is this generation we've brought in, we're mostly millennials right now in the Navy. Their built-in color blindness we'll start getting there more quickly.
One of the things that we had as a guest, the Secretary of the Air Force, Deborah Lee James, and one of the things that she talked about, despite the fact that the military is a meritocracy, is that she's got statistics within the Air Force that are showing that women in those kind of mid-rank, mid-management jobs are opting out of the management ranks. And so she's grappling with that, trying to understand the reasons why and put some programs in place to turn that around so that we continue to see the progress of women moving up the ranks and that pipeline doesn't get disturbed. What's your observation about that with the Navy? Are you seeing a similar situation?
So we have lower retention around the 3 to 7 year point for women compared to men, and then it starts to match up after that. But then the next big cliff is the 20-year point when they can retire. And so one of the things, first of all, when the combat exclusion law was repealed in 93, that meant for us, women were detailed into jobs, the same types of jobs men were detailed into. So for us, starting off out of ROTC or the Service Academy or OCS, women are starting off in what the other services would call combat arms. They start off in surface warfare, my community, or aviation, and now submarine duty. And then later on, if they want to, like the men, they can laterally transfer to another role. And some of them go off to get law degrees and become JAGs. Some of them become PAs. But the 3 to 7 point, the biggest common denominator, and it's men and women, is the separation. So we're an expeditionary force. So trying to manage a marriage and then a marriage with kids while you're going to be deployed for 6 or 7 months. And then you're going to be in that cycle for 3 years straight. Some folks just can't get there. For us, that is always going to be the nature of the beast, that going to sea and defending the country's interest is part of who we are. But there are other things we can do. And one of the biggest things we did was a career intermission program where, as you pointed out, there is a ladder, but it's pretty lockstep. And it's for men and women. And you can take up 1 to 2 to 3 years off. And we've had people go out. They said, okay, I'm going to get my master's degree and I'm going to have a child during this time frame. They get a small stipend, but then we reset their numerical number so that when they go back on active service and they're back in front of a promotion board, then their activity sets are at the same level as the other people they're being looked at. So we've already had one woman go out, had a child, got her master's degree, came back in, screened for command. She's an aviator, and she'll be coming up here for her 06 command. We had a SEAL go out and get his master's degree at Harvard, and we had a enlisted woman go out. She got her law degree and came back in as a JAG. There's just phenomenal opportunity. So we will have to look at how do we get at more things like the career intermission program, where you can take the equivalent to a sabbatical and do some things. Maybe you do it for the first 2 years of your child's life, and then you come back in and you keep going.
Admiral, the Pentagon recently announced an opening for women in all combat positions, and I'm going to quote Secretary of Defense Ash Carter. They will be allowed to drive tanks, fire mortars, lead infantry soldiers into combat, and everything else that was previously only open to men. What do you think about this change? Do you think that's going to help with the pipeline or, you know?
So for the Navy and Air Force, the big change for us was in 93 when we opened up combatant ships. So we've already had women COs of destroyers and cruisers. We've already had women who, you know, have done the, they've been COs of destroyers when the first missiles gone into Iraq. We've already had a woman carry a strike group commander. The first woman head of our Seabees who serve on a ground, two-star, just retired last year. So we're in a different place. So for us, the change to this policy, the one thing it opened up for us was SEALs, which is not a large community, very powerful community, obviously, but not a large community in the Navy. So once we opened up amphibious ships, cruisers and destroyers on the surface side, aircraft carriers, I mean, we've already had a woman fighter pilot who's head of squadron, and she's a captain now. We're in a different place, I think, than our land-focused services. And then I'm not worried about the SEALs. What people don't realize is we've had explosive ordnance techs in the Navy for over 30 years, and that's a group where it's only 2% women, and our most senior woman is a 2-star admiral. But, I mean, you got to be able to swim 500 meters in 12 minutes, you know, do 12 pull-ups, and, you know, at least 50. And these are the low-end numbers. This is, they normally do more than that. And the women EOD we have, they're phenomenal. So I suspect sooner or later somebody's going to say, well, rather than go off and be a diving someone who can defuse bombs underneath the water, diving type of skill set, I think I'd rather be a SEAL. That's going to happen. And then they'll just compete, and if they meet the standard, they'll be allowed to enroll in BUDS and compete again.
Today, our guest is Admiral Michelle Howard, Vice Chief of Naval Operations. Coming up, we'll find out what Admiral Howard likes to do when she's not working. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, our guest is Admiral Michelle Howard, Vice Chief of Naval Operations.
You are the recipient of the 2008 Women of Color Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math Career Achievement Award. And then you were also honored in 2013 with the Chairman's Award at the 44th NAACP Image Awards. So in doing the research for the interview, I read a lot about your commitment to improving the representation of women and minorities in STEM-related careers. And if you kind of look at the overall STEM numbers, they don't look too bad. But then when you look under the covers and you see, engineering and computer science, that's where the numbers are still, you know, sub 20% of the total for women. So what do you think, as a country, we can do to really help fix the STEM issue that we've got, but especially with regard to women and minorities?
So for... I had a conversation with her name's Dr. Pilling, and she's at Penn State, and this is her area of research. One of the things she's found that even when you get women and minorities into the college program, there's still bias on the college campus. And so you have to set up programs where women and minorities are reinforcing each other. They have shared experience sets as they go through. So I think the other answer would be if her studies, if you take her studies and say, okay, I believe what you're saying, and that there is still bias on the college campus. And actually, when she briefed me on her studies, I had a male captain who was working with me, and he listened to this, and then he got really angry because his daughter had been a biology major at a few years earlier at another school. And it was basically the professors who had told her, well, just women don't do well here, and given her all this negative feedback outside of her grades. And she just said, I just don't even want to try. And why would I want to work in an environment where they're not going to accept me? So I think Dr. Pilling is on to something, that we not only have to bring women in and bring minorities into the fields, make them feel comfortable with their brains at a younger age, but then we've got to make sure the college campus is reinforcing for them to graduate. I visited Carnegie Mellon and talked to a women's group of undergraduates. And I'm thinking, okay, this is exactly what every college needs, is a program like this where they can talk and do homework together.
Admiral, you are now the Vice Chief of Naval Operations, the first woman and the first African-American in this role, I believe.
Yes, yes.
First, tell us what it's like a day in a life in your current position.
So the Chief of Naval Operations has a broad mandate of training, equipping, and manning, our Title X responsibility. So that's everything from the policies that support that to oversight of the budget, dialogues, and getting to understanding of requirements, which helps drives design and the architect for the future fleet. So I do everything engagement with the senior civilian leaders in the Department of Defense and the Department of Navy, and then working our way through some major challenges, and then letting folks know what the military, the Navy, the senior Navy perspective is. When the CNO is on travel, then I am his replacement at the JCS. So the first time that happened, I think it was a Wednesday when I took the office. That Friday was the 4th of July. I was at the White House that for a naturalization ceremony where we brought in several sailors and made them U.S. citizens. And then that Sunday, I was on a Sunday morning talk show talking about Iraq and what our carriers were doing. Those were the first strikes against ISIL. And then that Monday was my first JCS tank. And the secretary came in and we all popped tall, and he says, hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. And then he sees me and he goes, oh, my gosh, good afternoon, lady and gentlemen. And he goes, wow, it's probably the first time that's been said in the tank. So it's more than a 9-to-5 job, and it's definitely every day of the week.
Your husband was also in the military, in the Marines. And how was it like trying to balance two separate military careers in two different branches?
Wayne and I, because he came in earlier, was enlisted and then became an officer, he was able to retire after 20 years. He went from 19 to age 39, and he retired. We both served in Desert Storm, and we were separated by 11 months during that time frame. He retired, and then he raised and talked to me about it. He said, I'm willing to follow you. He goes, I'm laying my bets on you. You're going to be something someday. And I said, well, that's great. You know, I have a husband who has that kind of, because I was like a brand new lieutenant commander at the point. And so he did. He committed to following me. And then he got some teasing from his former Marines, who referred to him as the camp follower for a while. And then he would just tell them, I think you guys are jealous. And of course they would admit they were. But no, he's been, I think I would have been long gone without his support.
Well, it's a bet that paid off pretty well for him, I would say. So what is it that you like to do when you're not working? I know you've already said it's not a 9-to-5 kind of job that you've got, but any hobbies or special interests?
So, I don't get at it as much as I used to, but I actually collect antique photography. I collect carte de visite, cabinet photos, daguerreotypes, and I focus on women and minorities. One of the things, I don't know where I got the notion, but I think I was in my 20s, and I suddenly realized whenever I was looking at history books, it was the same repeating image of African Americans and women. You know, it's like somebody's sharing some small slide deck of photos, you know. And so the imagery of the African Americans was only as slaves. And I go, that can't be right. There were free blacks. So I just started collecting just to see what was out there. And I was just astonished that there's all this other of people clearly living normal lives. And some of them accumulating wealth from the way they're dressed in the photos. And this positive, and for women, I've got great photographs of women with bicycles, you know, the big old tall standing bicycles. One woman dressed in a soldier's uniform. She may have been a daughter of the regiment. There's this whole other life out there of really positive imagery that talks about what women have done. And one of the most surprising things I found is I started focusing for paper photography. They used to have, the photographers would have a stamp on the back or something beautifully engraved, and they would use, then people would look on the back, and that was advertising for them. I've now come across 30 images where the photographer on the back was a woman. And so to me, there's this whole undocumented of women doing things out there that we just don't know, because the imagery we get in our, you know, high school books tells a story that's not the complete story. So I just got, my husband refers to it as an obsession. The more I collected, the more I couldn't stop collecting and go, wait, there's this whole other America out there that we don't appreciate.
That's amazing. But I have to ask you, if you were to go back to your younger self, Admiral Howard, and when you were just graduating from the Naval Academy, is there any advice that you would want her to have to help her achieve the kind of success that you have had both in your career and your personal life?
Well, I think all the wisdom my parents shared with us, you know, I believe I took and acted upon it, not just took it. And I don't think I would tell me to do anything different. I mean, I was at least, my mother refers to me as being precocious during those time frames. She goes, there was times you would say something, Nick and I would look at each other and go, we ought to do what she says. And so I listened to my parents, and I probably would say that's maybe the smartest first thing I did.
Today in the studio, we've been talking with Admiral Michelle Howard, Vice Chief of Naval Operations. I'm Gigi Shum.
I'm Aileen Black.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum, founders of Accelerated Government Strategies. Learn more about AGS and the work they do to help accelerate your business plans for public sector at excelgovstrat.com. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Women of Washington, Wednesday afternoons at 1 on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.